How do you do? Jen and Cam feel it would be unkind to present this program without a friendly word of warning. We are about to unfold our true crime podcast, a podcast of lifelong friends who seek to examine crimes which were committed without reckoning upon God. The discussion will be frank, and the subject matter will be of a grim and violent nature. I think it will thrill you. It might even horrify you. So, if there are young children listening, or if you feel unwilling to subject your nerves to such a strain, now is your chance to... Well, we've warned you.
Hey, Jen.
Hey, Cam. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, much better than last week. That's for sure.
Yeah,
when
I
had to have
emergency
oral surgery, I had a very bad abscessed tooth that was cracked and could not be saved.
It's your front one, right? The one right in front.
So it is. It is. Uh-huh. I only have the one front tooth now. It's awesome.
Okay. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you can eat soup without opening your mouth. You got to look at the positive things.
I know.
You know what I'm saying?
I'm so sick of eating soft food. It's not even funny.
I know. If you guys noticed, we didn't have an episode last week, and that is why. It's all Jen's
fault. And we apologize. I apologize.
Totally.
I'm sorry.
Jen,
but to make it up, I've got a kind of long episode this week. So
Longish.
So
I've worked
really hard on. I've used 3 different books and the internet. You know, when you use so many different resources, and there's so many different facts, in quotation marks, to use.
It's almost too much.
It gets confusing.
Yeah.
So I'll try to point them out as I come to them. But to tell you the truth, after a while, I just went and stuck with 3 resources.
Yeah. Well, you kind of have to. It's overwhelming. And then
people
contradict each other, and then you got to go look it up and see which one's right or which one you think's right.
I got you. So I will discuss my resources at the end of the case here. You ready?
I am so ready. Let's go.
Cam, today we are headed to Soham in East Cambridgeshire, England. Now, Soham is a small English town with a population close to 11,000. It's about an hour or two northeast of London. Jessica Chapman and Holly Wells were best friends, kind of like you and I. They had met at nursery school, and by the age of 10, they were pretty much attached to the hip. They were always together. They were the typical 10-year-old girls. Jessica was the sporty tomboy, Sporty Spice. Played soccer, and she loved to swim. She mostly wore t-shirts. She didn't like anything too girly, and she usually kept her shoulder-length brown hair pulled up in a ponytail. Holly liked sports, too, but she was more musically inclined. One of the many things the girls had in common was their love for Manchester United soccer player, the captain of
his
team.
Go Man U!
They loved the team's captain, David Beckham.
Yeah, baby.
Who doesn't, really? That's why, you know, Holly's kind of posh Spice, correct?
Yeah.
But the blonde-haired Holly was more of a girly girl. She loved to wear dresses and dressing up and having her hair put in braids. And both girls, they were very bright, they were very responsible and well-behaved. They were taught not to talk to strangers and always let their parents know exactly where they were at all times. Jessica was actually known to call her mother by her cell phone and check in, and Holly would call her folks even if she thought she was going to be a minute late. In early August, the Chapmans had just returned for a 2-week vacation from the Spanish island of Menorca. I'd always love to go to Spain. How nice would it be to just go for a short vacation to Spain?
That's kind of like Florida for us, I'm guessing.
Exactly, I guess. Yeah. I don't know. Menorca sounds much more...
I'd much rather go to Spain. Exactly.
So Jessica, they had been away for 2 weeks, and Jessica could not wait to see Holly and tell her all about her trip. And she even had bought a souvenir necklace for her bestie. Now, this is one where the reports that I've had differed. One was a necklace that had a pendant by the name... It had love on it. And the other one, it was a wooden pendant with the letter H in a circle, and then surrounding the H was 2 dolphins.
Kids always like dolphins. They really do.
And how sweet of it to get her friend a souvenir. I don't get you anything. Yeah. You don't get me anything when you go away. But you know what? We haven't gone away in a while. So. Yeah. And when we do, it's usually together,
when I go
right?
2 miles to school.
Yeah. Exactly. On the morning of Sunday, August 4th, 2002, Jessica called Holly and they made plans for a sleepover. They only lived a 5-minute walk away from each other, and Holly's house was one of the few places Jessica could go alone. Making sure she had her cell phone with her, Jessica took off to Holly's house and made it there around 11:30, 11:45. Another friend of the two, Natalie, had spent the previous night with Holly, and the three girls messed around on the computer until Natalie's mom picked her up. Holly's parents, Nicola and Kevin, had another couple coming over for a barbecue, so the girls spent the afternoon in Holly's room playing on the computer and doing whatever 10-year-old girls do. In the late afternoon, early evening, Jessica and Holly went downstairs. They were wearing matching outfits, which they always liked to do. Isn't it cute?
It is. It's just little girls. I love it.
They both were wearing a red Manchester United shirt with David Beckham's on the back and the number 7, and black Adidas shorts. Now, Jessica had borrowed the clothes from Holly's 12-year-old brother, Oliver. They looked so cute, Holly's mother made them pose for the now-famous picture, which was also the last picture the two girls would ever take. This is the picture that was used in every missing persons poster and newspaper. So I guess we know what's going to happen here, right? And I'm assuming a lot of people know this story. Not story.
I think you might be surprised, episode. Actually. Yeah.
Around 5:30, the girls slipped quietly out of the house to go for a walk and headed to the center of Soham without Kevin or Nicola knowing. Later, the police would be able to retrace the girls' final steps before they disappeared. The girls were seen walking around the town, just rambling, doing fun things. At 6:15 p.m., CCTV cameras caught them walking outside the Ross Pierce Sports Center. A manager working there would later remember seeing them at a vending machine. Then, cameras show them setting off towards Soham Village College, close to where the schools went to St. Anthony's Primary School. They seemed to not have a care in the world nor a destination in mind. They were just happy to be together, wandering around the town. Then, after a final CCTV caught them wandering around town, there was nothing else. The girls simply vanished. At approximately 8 p.m., Nicola Wells had called upstairs for her daughter. She wanted Holly to say goodbye to their guests. There was no answer. Nicola started calling for Holly and Jessica while searching the house. Nothing, no answer. Nicola looked in the garden and up and down the street. Nothing. The girls were gone. Now, Holly had a curfew of 8:30, so they were pretty hopeful, you know, thinking the girls would soon be at the door because Holly was very punctual. She was never late, or she would call if she was late. But at 8:45 p.m., the girls still weren't home. Nicola then decided to call Jessica's parents, Leslie and Sharon Chapman. She was hoping the girls were playing at their house. At 8:45 p.m., the girls still weren't home, so Nicola decided to call Jessica's parents, Leslie and Sharon Chapman. She was hoping to find the girls playing at their house. They weren't. Both sets of parents started to worry. Sharon called Jessica's mobile phone, and the call went straight to Jessica's voicemail. It never rang. Each time Sharon dialed, it completely went to voicemail. Jessica never turned off her phone. Something was wrong, and now full panic set in. Kevin Wells took off on his bike looking for the girls, and Leslie Chapman went to search for the girls by car. Sharon and her oldest daughter, Rebecca, took off in the other car and went the opposite direction. After an hour of searching, Sharon went to the Wells home. Both mothers tried to think where Jessica and Holly could have gone. Finally, at 10 p.m., they called the police. Within minutes, the police arrive. They ask for a list of Holly and Jessica's friends and sent officers to each house looking for the girls. Natalie, the friend that was at Holly's house earlier, she was woken up at 2 a.m. by an officer asking where the girls may have gone. At 1 a.m., the police enlist phone engineers from Vodafone to try to track the signal of Jessica's pay-as-you-go cell. The last signal was detected in the Soham area. They didn't have much time, so they couldn't pinpoint the exact location. And just to be sure that Jessica would be able to contact them, they thought maybe her phone had died. They loaded the phones with extra credit. Police, family, and friends searched for the girls throughout the night. One policewoman with the police dog came across the grounds and asked the caretaker, Ian Huntley, to help her search the grounds and possibly give her keys so she could go inside buildings to help search for the girls. He obliged and even took her inside. Ian happened to mention that he had heard about the missing girls but hadn't seen them at all. Now, after they searched inside, WPC Burton noticed a large shed in the back. Now, this is where they kept all the grounds equipment. She asked if she could search there, but Ian said that, you know what, I don't have the keys with me right now.
Mm-hmm.
She did a sweep around the building. She even banged on the doors, but she didn't find anything. The officer thanked Ian for his help and went back on her way. The officer had just left when a teacher by the name of Susan came by. She was also searching for the girls. Ian mentioned to her that he had seen the girls the previous day around 6:50. She insisted that Ian immediately report it to the police, which he did. And the officer that spoke with him that evening, or middle of the night, I should say, said he seemed a bit nervous.
Oh.
Kevin Wells gathered some friends to help search. At 4:15, Kevin showed up on the Soham Village College campus wanting to search the grounds. Now, Kevin knew the caretaker, Ian, because Kevin owned a window washing company and he had contracts with the school, so they had met prior. When they asked Ian if he had seen the girls, he said he hadn't. And without being asked, he stated that he was at the school so early because he was writing a note for another colleague explaining that he was going to be late because the police had woke him up to talk to him. Early the next morning, in respectable business hours, the police go to Ian's house to get a statement from him, since he said that he did see the girls. And the police noted that he looked like he hadn't slept all night, but he was freshly showered and his home smelled lemony fresh, like the smell of cleaning fluids. Ian told him that he was outside his home cleaning his dog when the girls walked past around 6 o'clock or so. He said that they had chatted about his girlfriend Maxine before heading off College Road. Now, Maxine had been a teaching assistant at the girls' school, and they absolutely adored her. And during the conversation with the police, he insinuated that Maxine had been in the house when the girls were there. Ian claimed that he hadn't realized that the girls that he had seen were actually Jessica and Holly, and it only occurred to him later when somebody had mentioned that the missing girls had on matching Manchester United shirts. After the police left, Ian started cleaning again. In fact, he had been doing a lot of cleaning up.
Mm-hmm.
So, Camille, I got to ask you, is your spidey senses tingling?
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
I don't like them.
Yep. As you may suspect or even know, Ian knew exactly where the girls were. In fact, he was shaking in his boots because he spent most of the evening getting rid of the evidence.
Ugh.
So let's talk about Ian. Ian is something else. Let me just put it that way.
Yes, he is.
So Ian Kevin Huntley was born into a working-class family in Grimsby in England on January 31st, 1974, to Kevin and Linda Huntley. When he was almost 2 years old, he had a little brother come along by the name of Wayne. Now, Ian was instantly jealous of his brother and would continue to be all of his life. He would throw fits if his mother even dared pay attention to Wayne in any way, shape, or form. Ian, of course, was what? A loner at school. He wasn't liked at all, and he was often bullied. One former classmate said, quote, he was the kind of kid who would give a lot of mouth to people, but when they turned on him, he would go running to the teacher. Ian would later tell people he was beaten and sexually abused by an adult, but knowing what we know now about what a horrible liar and a manipulator he is, it's really hard to know if something this terrible really did happen to him. Around 11 or 13, Ian changed schools, and guess what? He was still unpopular and bullied. Some people remember him as, quote, a scruffy outcast. He was not very sporty, and when he had to play soccer or football, he would fake a massive asthma attack. Now, he did have asthma, but it was pretty obvious that he was faking it. Kind of like we always had cramps when it was time to run the mile. You know?
Yes.
But we weren't obnoxious about it. He obviously was. At 13, Ian became interested in airplanes and decided he wanted to join the Royal Air Force when he got older, although he never did. I think closest he came to planes was watching them and putting models of them together.
Okay.
Ian always craved attention, and at one point he attempted suicide by stealing his mother's painkillers. He was found unconscious and taken to the hospital, and his stomach was pumped. Now, classmates at school, they knew he really didn't want to die. He wanted people to feel sorry for him.
Just attention. We all know people like that, right?
And some thought he only did it because his affections for a girl had been rejected. Mm. Ian, as a young kid, even loved to boast about his sex life. He would tell people he had his first kiss when he was 12 and that he lost his virginity at 14. You could say he was a predator at an early age. A classmate of his said, quote, his technique with the girls was to pick on the youngest, most easily conned ones he could find and basically just lie to them. Get where I'm going here?
Yeah.
Ian left school at 16 and began working at menial jobs. He gutted fish for a living for a while, and then he did factory work. He moved around a lot, too, like 8 places in 4 years. He was constantly moving, changing apartments. In 1993, his parents divorced, and Ian blamed his father. He told people that his dad had been having affairs, which was untrue. But Ian never really had a great relationship with his dad, and this kind of pushed him over the edge. So Ian started using his mother's maiden name, Nixon. So now he kind of sometimes goes by the name of Ian Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
Ian would go to clubs to find women. The more vulnerable the women were, the better. He would lie to them and say he was a pilot or some other exciting career. He would never tell them that he was a factory worker. Nope. And the closest thing he came to being a pilot would be going out to watch the planes near Air Force bases.
We all got a dream, Jen.
We do. Well, and as earlier mentioned, too, Ian liked young girls. When he was 18, he lured a 12-year-old into his apartment and gave her Alco Pops, which is kind of like coolers, like fruity malt liquor beverages. Ben and Jerry, not Ben and Jerry's, that's an ice cream.
Bartles and James.
Bartles and James, yeah. After she was completely drunk, he raped her. Huh. Now, a lot of people, some of the things that are like, oh, he had sex with her. There's no sex when you're dealing with a 12-year-old girl.
She's 12.
Rape. Too young to consent to having sex with anyone. He raped her. When he was in his 20s, he told an 11-year-old girl that he was her boyfriend, lured her into his bedroom. He then kissed her and tried to touch her in a sexual manner. She stopped him. He then became very angry and he locked the door and threatened her. And he said that he would not let her leave until they had sex. She started to scream and he let her go. He didn't want to draw any attention from the neighbors. Now, during his 20s, Ian targeted young girls, like actually targeted them. He would groom them. And it said that he raped dozens of girls under the age of 16, with the youngest being only 11.
Ugh.
He would find his victims. He would be kind to them, shower them with compliments, basically grooming them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then he would manipulate them and coax them to get them alone. And a lot of the times he had to use force to rape them. Sometimes they were willing, but it's still rape because they're underage. But a lot of the times he forced them. Then afterwards, like a true pedophile does, he would scare them into not telling anyone.
The idea that he was older than them, that is grooming. And he is, I mean, I hate to say it, he's smarter and he puts the fear in them. There's no doubt that was grooming.
Could you imagine being a 12-year-old little girl and some older man comes and like, oh my God, you're so beautiful. I just love you. You know what I mean? They're young and dumb and not book dumb, just dumb in the
ignorant,
ways of the world.
Like, literally ignorant. Yeah.
Right. In December of 1994, Ian met 19-year-old Claire and the two fell in love and got married within weeks. Surprise! Marriage didn't last very long. Ian was very abusive, verbally and physically. He would fly into a rage almost daily for no reason. Ian, in fact, beat her until she was blue. Claire left Ian just weeks after getting married. He begged her not to leave. Couldn't live without her. He apologized. He did all the things that abusers do. And one night before she actually left, Ian started drooling and he faked a seizure. This scared Claire and she called an ambulance, which turned out to be a total waste of the paramedics' time. There was nothing wrong with him, just desperate to keep her. One person who did help Claire and she would seek comfort from was Wayne, Ian's brother. The two fell in love and wanted to be together. And this, of course, only made things worse. Ian, you know, was jealous of Wayne from the get-go. But now Wayne was going to have Claire? No. And not to mention the fact that Wayne was an engineer for who? The Royal Air Force.
Oh.
Something Ian had dreamed of doing. Here Ian is working in a factory and going just job to job, you know, and Ian, and here's Wayne doing things that Ian dreamed of.
That happens a lot with brothers, you know, and sisters, siblings, I guess. It happens a lot with. Okay, go ahead.
Well, Ian was furious, and to get back at the two, he wouldn't grant Claire a divorce for years because she wanted to marry Wayne and couldn't do it because Ian wouldn't divorce her. At the age of 23, Ian started dating a 15-year-old girl by the name of Katie. He met Katie when he worked with her mother. After finding out that, you know, the mom had a teenage girl, he started to finagle the way into the family. He even moved into an RV or a caravan in their backyard. Katie became enamored with him, and he emotionally blackmailed her.
Mm.
Ian convinced her to quit school. He kept her away from her family, and they moved in together. And just like before, Ian would scream at Katie and he would beat her and he would always apologize later, just like he did with Claire. The isolation and the abuse finally got to her. And after a year, Katie called her dad and she escaped. She escaped Ian's home, but she was pregnant with his child.
Nope.
Now, interesting fact, years later, like 14 years later, a young girl would be sitting at her computer doing a project for school, and she would discover that she was the biological daughter of Ian Huntley.
Shocker.
Yeah, could you imagine being 14 years old and discovering that your father is Ian Huntley? And we'll discuss.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, because we have a true crime podcast, but no.
Yeah, but I mean, I would be. Her mother had never told her, and with good reason.
Mm-hmm.
On another occasion, Ian was at a nightclub and he found his next victim. An 18-year-old blonde that was dancing on the dance floor. Ian went up beside her and started dancing right next to her. She couldn't get him away from her. He was like constantly on her. He watched every move she made at the club. When she finally left at 2 a.m., Ian followed her. When she turned into an alley, Ian grabbed her, punched her in the face, and raped her. After the brutal attack, Ian threatened her not to tell. And when he went to turn around to do something, the girl ran away. She ran home and she immediately called the police and reported it.
Thank goodness she got away, really.
The next day it made the papers and it took Ian 5 days to turn himself in. And he was arrested, but he never went to trial. They couldn't find any evidence or anything to corroborate what happened. The only witnesses that had come forward had saw the two dancing at the club, but yet nobody saw anything in the alley. No one saw the rape. In February 1999, he met 22-year-old Maxine Carr at a nightclub, and after dating a month, they moved in together. Their relationship was just as bad as all the others, and Maxine was a quiet woman with very low self-worth. She had dealt with bulimia and anorexia all her life. She was the type of woman, she's very shy and anxious during the day, but she would only come out of her shell after drinking.
Drinking. I knew you were going to say that.
She liked how Ian, this is my own personal thing. I think she liked the way Ian was controlling, and I think she liked that. She liked his jealousy. She liked.
Yeah,
that's just me. My analysis. I didn't read that. That's just what I got out of this whole thing.
I can see that.
Mm-hmm. In September of 2001, Ian applied for a job as caretaker or in the custodial janitor.
The custodial arts, that's what I used to call it.
Custodial arts, yes.
Hayden was 2 years old and would clean up all the time. Boy, those days are gone. Okay, go ahead.
He applied for a job as caretaker at the Soham Village College, and he used his last name Nixon to do so because of all his prior charges.
Mm-hmm.
or not charges, but he was kind of known to the police
some
for
problems.
His little escapades. Yeah.
Issues, if you will.
And in November 2001, despite being accused of having sex with underage girls and of rape many times in the past, he was given the job. And Maxine found a job at St. Anthony's Primary School as an assistant teacher. That's the same school that Sharon Chapman worked. In fact, Maxine was in the same classroom as Jessica and Holly, but Maxine wasn't given the contract for the next year, and the girls were very disappointed. They loved her, but we'll talk about that later. Mm. The weekend that Holly and Jessica vanished, Ian was solo. Maxine was at her mother's house in Grimsby, and Ian was not happy about it. In fact, he was angry that she was going
jealous?
Out. Jealous. Okay. He couldn't control her. If she was away, how was he going to control her? His quote, "I was annoyed that she was going out again. I know what Maxine can be like when she's had a few drinks. She gets a bit loud and a bit flirty sometimes." He called her cell many times on Saturday, demanding to know what she was doing and who she was with, but she wouldn't pick up the phone. By 6:24 p.m. on Sunday, Maxine finally called, and Ian flew off the handle. The two argued for exactly 2 minutes and 13 seconds before Ian hung up. At 6:30 p.m., Maxine sent Ian a text saying, quote, "Don't make me feel bad, I'm with my family." So let's get back to what happened with Jessica and Holly. That's all we're going to talk about for Ian and Maxine right now. That's a lot, isn't it? Isn't he like a son of a bitch?
We got the idea. Like, he's a pedophile.
He's a horrible person. He's scum of the earth.
He's a pedophile. He's a he's a stalker. He's a
creeper.
He's an asshole. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. By 6:30 a.m. on Monday morning, Holly and Jessica's fathers had covered every inch of Soham and the surrounding areas many times over. They were exhausted and had to sleep. Actually, one of Kevin's friends said it would be so sad because Kevin would be calling out into these empty fields and all that could be heard was his echoes.
Oh,
heartbreaking.
God.
But by this time, the Cambridgeshire police had sent out 100 police officers and they went door to door. They searched fields surrounding the town and they went to hang missing persons posters. Divers searched any areas with water. Search dogs were called in. I mean, it seems they used the infrared things to check fields. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
The infrared.
Yeah, they were looking for
heat things.
Mm-hmm.
Body listen
heat.
To me talking all technical. Yeah.
Infrared. Heat.
The infrared heat source things to see if they were lying in the field somewhere.
Awful.
They did. They tried to use every resource they had to find these poor 10-year-old girls.
Well, as we all know, time is of the essence. And each minute that goes by, it's.
Well, at this point, they think they thought they ran away for some reason.
But still.
Another 500 people and officers from the neighboring towns of Suffolk and Essex came to help out the Cambridgeshire police in the search. And it goes again for another 16 hours. When the police were done searching the school grounds again, Ian started to clean again.
Of course
he scrubbed the entire house, and he even did laundry, which was probably the first time he ever did it in his entire life, to be quite honest.
I'm laughing.
I could be wrong.
Right.
I could just totally make that up, but I'm just saying.
Hey, you know what? When you're a jerk, we can make those assumptions.
When you're an abusive jerk that likes to domineer women and hurt children.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. I think it's okay.
All right. Then he took his car. He had all the tires changed in the next town over. Now, his tires were barely a year old. He even had a new license plate put on. That only cost him an extra $10 or so. He then cleaned the car, made sure it was immaculate. He vacuumed it out. He ripped up the carpet that was in the trunk. He replaced it with an old mat. And then he had the audacity to help search for the girls.
Of course he did.
He led them to places, you know, that it just, such an asshole. On Monday afternoon, the Wells and Chapmans held the first press conference. Leslie begged Jessica to come home. After it was over, Kevin turned around and he saw Ian right behind him. And he said that Ian looked really tired and he had, quote, panda baggy eyes. Ian apologized and said, you know what? Sorry, I didn't realize the missing girls were, you know, it was your daughter that was missing. I'm really sorry. And then he also mentioned that he needed to talk to the police again because, you know what? I think in the statement that I gave them, the times were off.
Huh. Did he really know that was Kevin's kid or not?
No idea, to be honest.
I'm just wondering if that affected him. Like, oh, crap, I didn't realize that was your kid. You know what I'm saying?
If it affected him, I had no idea. But I think at the time, I'm not sure if he knew it was Holly was Kevin's kid.
Yeah.
So on Tuesday, the news of the missing girls spread quickly across the country. David Beckham, captain of Manchester United, even issues a statement along with his teammates saying, quote, please go home. You are not in any kind of trouble. Your parents love you deeply and want you back.
It's heartbreaking.
Thousands of people wrote to the families and offered their prayers and support, and they all hoped the girls would be found safe and would come home soon. On Tuesday, around 4:30 p.m., Ian called Maxine. She was still in Grimsby visiting her family and drinking, going out. Ian told Maxine she had to come home right now. He told her that Holly and Jessica were missing and they had been inside their house at 5 College Close.
Now, if you were Maxine, wouldn't you be like, say, what? Excuse me? Two missing girls have been in our house?
I love you, Mickey. Yeah.
Absolutely not.
Mm-hmm. Ian told Maxine he was scared that the police would make him a suspect in their disappearance. Maxine agreed to come home. And the next day, Ian drove up to Grimsby and picked Maxine up. And Ian would convince Maxine to lie for him because he needed an alibi. Maxine agreed to the alibi. They came up with the plan. Maxine
Honestly,
would tell police.
Let me just stop you there real quick. No matter how much you love someone, be it anybody, your brother, your sister, your parent, your lover, your husband, your wife, whatever, if they say, hey, I need you to lie about this alibi for me, what, I mean, is that a red flag?
Maxine supposedly loved these little girls. They were in the class that she was helped assist, you know, that
even,
she assisted.
Even more so. Wait, I'm not going to lie for you. Are you kidding me right now?
Right. Especially something that could be this big.
Okay.
So anyway, they came up with a plan, the little alibi. Maxine would tell the police that she was at home all weekend and while the girls were at the house that she was in the bathtub. By Friday, the police disclosed that they think Jessica and Holly may have been kidnapped and they very well may still be alive and just held captive somewhere. Another press conference was then called and Jessica's parents made an emotional appeal for the abductors. And Leslie said, all I can say is they're not your children. Just give them back. Sharon added, drop them off somewhere that's safe. Just drop them off at a hospital or someone's house. It's never too late.
Ugh.
Police searched through the computer that Holly and Jessica had been using, and they tried to see if anyone had contacted her through emails or chat groups. They checked the sex offenders register, and they tried to trace down any pedophiles in the area to interview them. And guess what? Ian wasn't on the list.
Ian Huntley or Ian Nixon?
Both.
Mark.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Police even go so far to use two young actresses that looked like the girls, and they staged a reenactment of Holly and Jessica's last known moves, just hoping to jog people's memories.
That's odd. Is that
odd?
Could
you imagine?
I think that's odd.
I do too. So people started bombarding the police with sightings of the girls. They were calling from all over saying that they saw two girls with the Manchester United shirts, blah, blah, blah. Nothing ever panned out. In fact, it got so bad that the police asked the public to stop wearing the red Manchester United shirts just until they can figure out what was going on. They did get a lead from a jogger. While he was out around 10 o'clock at night, he had heard teenagers near a wooded area the night the girls disappeared. Upon searching, they found two mounds of earth that looked like graves. It was horrible. The family was devastated. Police liaison was sent to the house to wait with them for the news. Police sent a team of forensic archaeologists to evacuate the scene. They dug through the mounds, and it turned out to be a badger's den.
Oh.
And which was a relief, thank God. And they just assumed that the badgers were probably the ones that made the sounds that sounded like screamings. I've never heard what a badger sounds like, so I'm not sure if that would be true or not. as you would expect, two pretty girls, two pretty white girls, let me put that in, goes missing. They're from a middle-class family. What's going to happen? The media is just going to
go crazy.
Go crazy. And at that point, they were looking for anybody to interview, anybody that knew the girls. Mm-hmm. And guess who was willing to come on camera? That's right. Maxine Carr.
Mm-hmm. Never saw that coming.
Mm-mm. Maxine told Sky News that Jessica had been out on holiday the last week of school, but Holly had made her a card with a smiley face on the front and a poem inside. And she actually showed the card that Holly made on the air. She said Holly had also given her a box of chocolates on the last day of school, and that Holly was so upset because Maxine wasn't going to be back the next year. Her contract wasn't renewed. After the interview, Sky News presenter Jeremy Thompson would comment, quote, "Both my producers said, well, that's odd. She was speaking in past tense, like the girls weren't around anymore. Maybe we should mention that to the police," they said. And one of the examples, she was going, "Oh, Holly was such a lovely, lovely, lovely girl. That's the type of girl she was." Like, that always in past tense.
Gives me shivers. Clue. Yep, mm-hmm. Clue. Big time. Yep.
Ian Huntley also spoke with the media, and he claimed that he was one of the last people to see the girls. Which, how did he know? Nobody knew. Police didn't know that. And then later, when he would start asking questions about DNA and asking people if the girls' clothing had been found, how would he know that?
Yeah, not suspicious at all there, Ian Nixon Huntley.
Following Maxine Carr's television appearance, people from her hometown of Grimsby were calling the police and saying that, you know what, Maxine wasn't in the bathtub. There's no way. No way. I'd seen her out with her mother in Grimsby. That was over 100 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
Still working on where Jessica's mobile phone was last pinged, police finally established that the final signal was emitted at 6:46 p.m. on the day the girls disappeared. They called this the goodbye signal, and it was picked up by a cell phone mast about 5 miles south of Soham, and it proved without a doubt that Jessica's phone had been switched off and disconnected from the network at 5 College Close, where who lived? Ian and Maxine. Now, they had already been kind of suspicious of Ian in the first place, but they just immediately put on a 24-hour surveillance on Ian. Now, like I said, they'd been suspicious of him, and they had looked into his past and of all of his aliases, but they digged a bit further, and they found out about his prior rape charge. On August 16th, Ian and Maxine were brought in to be questioned while forensic experts searched their home and the Soham Village College where Ian worked. They were questioned for 7 hours and then released at different stations. And you know what Ian did when they kind of asked him about the murders?
I'm scared.
Or what happened to the girls? You know what he did?
I'm scared.
He tried the old drooling and foaming at the mouth bit.
I'm sorry. That is not funny. But really?
Really?
Did that one. You did that one before, buddy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, he did this, obviously. He did this a lot of times from what it sounds like. It didn't work with the police.
Maybe I should. No, I'm not going to say it.
Start it?
Say,
yeah.
Maybe I should do that when I get out of talking to somebody because it buys you a
lot of time. Lord have mercy, this man, the cojones on him. Anyway.
He sure did.
Saturday morning, August 17th, police searched the college grounds once again. Inside a trash can next to the big shed on the college grounds, police notice something under the trash bag, under a trash bag. At the bottom of the trash can. You know what I mean? You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, yes.
When he pulled the trash bag out, he could see a red Manchester United t-shirt with Beckham's name and the number 7 on the back. It smelled of smoke and it had scorch marks. He reached again into the trash can and pulled out another red t-shirt, black shorts, 3 small white tennis shoes, and some underwear. I think one of it was a bra that one of the girls' mothers had bought them the day before, like a little training bra.
Little training bra. Oh my God.
The police immediately arrest Maxine and Ian on suspicion of murder.
Good.
Ian was arrested at his parents' home at 4:20 a.m., and Maxine was arrested in her hotel room about 5 minutes later. Forensics would later find 5 strands of hair belonging to Ian Huntley on the clothes and also his handprint on the bag that he used to try to conceal the clothes. When police arrest Ian at his parents' house, he started talking gibberish and did what?
Had a seizure.
Started drooling and foaming at the mouth again.
What? Oh, dude. Trick's been done. One trick, Tony. Come on now.
Yep. Come on. Give it up. Just hours later, a gamekeeper and 2 others were checking on some pheasants in a wooded area near an Air Force base at Mildenhall in Suffolk when they noticed a horrible smell. It was so pungent, they decided to look for what was causing it. That's never a good idea.
No.
I just can't do it. They thought somebody. It might have been like animal, like manure, or maybe there was a dead deer or lamb or something.
Big animal, yeah.
Yeah. In a 5-foot-deep, waterlogged ditch, they see a small, badly disfigured body of a child.
Oh.
It was burnt to the point where the tiny skeleton was showing through the charred remains of the flesh. And lying next to it was another blackened body, barely recognizable as human. They were lying next to each other on their backs with their legs draped over one another. Police officers would later say that it appeared to whomever had put them there had taken great pains to destroy them.
Tried to.
Pathologist Dr. Nat Carey said that the flesh had been burnt to the point where they had become, quote, partly skeletonized. Dr. Carey also stated, quote, if they had not been discovered on that Saturday, decomposition was such that they might not have ever been found. They were very close to having wholly disappeared apart from the skeletons. When Dr. Carey was asked the cause of death, he said, quote, a positive cause of death in each case was impossible to establish because of the state of the bodies. It, however, does leave asphyxia as the most likely cause. And Dr. Carey concluded that the girls' bodies were dumped at the site shortly after they were killed. While it would take a few days to get the DNA back to identify the bodies, police on the scene found things that made them certain that they were looking at the remains of Holly and Jessica. They found a part of a pocket of the pair of black athletic shorts, along with the plastic logo. And they also found a beaded necklace that Jessica always wore, and it was still around her neck. Police also found Holly's necklace in the ditch, the one that was the gift from Jessica.
Hmm.
Now, they went back and they did all the... They searched Ian's house. They searched his car. They collected fibers and evidence and all this thing. But I found this really interesting. When police went back to his home, they noticed how much had been deep cleaned. And they took out the vacuum cleaner and they looked at the contents of the vacuum cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know that you can find fibers and such inside the canister,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
But did you know you could cause problems with using a vacuum cleaner too? Because just as it sucks up fibers, it can also put fibers down elsewhere.
I could see. I have a dog,
yeah.
So yeah,
no,
I could see
yeah.
that. But yeah, you don't think of that.
No. So he was vacuuming the house, and he might have killed them in the living room,
mm-hmm.
but they found fibers in other places of the house.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I
so
just
he,
thought that was
he
interesting.
Thought he was being so smart that he's going to clean up everything, right? And he's
right.
actually distributing fibers and other evidence throughout the house.
Yeah, they were able to find fibers of the girls' clothing all throughout the house. You know? It just amazed me. I never
you
even
just
thought.
Don't
I just
think
thought you'd vacuum
yeah.
things up and yeah. it would be done, right?
Yeah.
Let's now have to remember it. That. And if I ever happen to...
Yeah, let's not say that. That's terrible.
So while awaiting trial, Ian attempted suicide twice.
Ugh.
Maxine went back on her little bulimic anorexia thing and quit eating, and she had to be given a feeding tube. And she also tried to kill herself by slitting her wrists. And Ian did go to the hospital to get a psychological test, and he was deemed fine, even mm-hmm. though he could drool and foam at the mouth on cue. There was nothing wrong with him. But this made me laugh, and it's not. But on one of the suicide attempts that Ian did, he wrote a note. He wrote a suicide note.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, he wrote something like, "Wayne is not allowed at my funeral."
Okay, buddy.
I'm sure Wayne doesn't give a shit anymore. You just, you're, you know,
you were a child.
You've been accused of
killer. So whatever. Good luck, buddy. Anybody showing up at your funeral. Good luck.
Thank you. Good luck. You're having your body claimed. Anyway, I just thought that just kind of made me giggle
that,
a little bit.
That's how out of touch these people are. Right. Seriously. Like they don't. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, it just made me. Yeah. It struck me as funny. Maybe I was just giddy from working on this. I don't know. On November 5th, 2003, the trial began. Prosecutors submitted over 550 pieces of evidence, including soil matching the ditch where the girls' bodies were found. Now, remember, Ian changed out the tires,
mm-hmm.
right? Because he didn't mm-hmm. want any evidence. They found this soil in the wheel well of Ian's car.
See, investigators are amazing.
They
that
know
kind
what
of stuff
they're
going to
do.
That just wows me, really.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing.
You cannot get away. Today, it is so hard to get away with a crime.
Well, and it just so happened that where he left the bodies, it's kind of like a mixture of ground up shells.
Mm-hmm.
And
so they know where you're from. They can tell
where
it was.
Yeah, and there was pollen that was only in that certain area. I mean, just amazing.
Yeah, it is.
Amazing.
Really.
Kudos to all those forensic people. When Ian took the stand, he told his version of what happened on that August day. He said he had been outside of his house at 5 College Close cleaning Sadie, his dog, when the girls came down the road. He took Holly and Jessica into his house because Holly had a nosebleed. He said that there was no toilet tissue downstairs, so he took them upstairs, and Holly sat on the edge of the bathtub, which was filled with water.
Mm.
He gave her some tissues to stop the blood, and then Ian said he took Holly into his bedroom and sat on the bed while Jessica used the bathroom, the toilet. Moments later, he took Holly back to the bathroom, where she was able to finish cleaning up after her nosebleed. Ian said that as he went to pass Holly to get some more tissue, he, quote, sort of turned and either slipped or lost his footing and, quote, sort of went forward in the direction of Holly. Ian said that Holly fell backward and he heard a splash as she entered the bath, as she entered the water.
Mm-hmm.
Then he said he placed his hand over Jessica's mouth because she kept repeatedly screaming, quote, "You pushed her, you pushed her, you pushed her in." He told the court that he, quote, just panicked and froze. As Holly drowned and Jessica was somehow suffocated at his hands, he added, quote, "I checked Holly's breathing and her neck and her wrist for a pulse up to that point. I hadn't really been aware of Jessica. I hadn't registered that she was lying there. I put my face close to her mouth for breathing. I've never been really hot at checking pulses."
Mm-hmm.
Ian said he never meant for either death to happen. And, quote, "One died as a result of my inability to act, and the other died as a direct result of my actions." He then said that he did pull Holly from the bath and checked her pulse, and there was nothing there. And then he leaned over to Jessica's mouth and to check for the breathing, and there wasn't any breathing. Then he went out in the hallway, and he just sat huddled in the corner, vomiting, just throwing up.
Mm-hmm.
Then he said how he drove the bodies and dumped them in a ditch near Lake and Heath, the airport. And he said, quote, "I picked up one of the girls. I'm not sure which one. The bank of the ditch was too deep to carry the girls down, so I had to place one of them on top of the ditch and push her so she rolled down, then returned to the car and did the same thing." Then he talked about how he poured gasoline over the bodies. Quote, "I went part of the way down the ditch, then backwards and forwards." Then he said the fire flared up. Prosecutors said Ian lured the girls into his house, then he attacked them. And that was most likely, it was a spur-of-the-moment thing. It wasn't planned. And since there weren't any signs of weapons being used, they believe Ian most likely strangled them.
They haven't mentioned that he raped them, though, right? And I'm sure he did.
There was no sign of rape. There was no sign of rape.
Of course he did.
Because they were partially skeletonized.
But he did.
They were burned too badly.
You know he did.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he is. He'd never just kill them.
Since there weren't any signs of a weapon being used, Ian most likely strangled them. Police did find that Ian had 3 faint scratch marks on the left side of his face, just under his chin. So there was some fight involved.
Good.
There also was not any form or sign that the girls had been molested or raped in any way. They couldn't find anything.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't much to find, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
After the girls were dead, it's believed that Ian started cleaning up. He took the girls in the bathroom and he washed their bodies. His man is worried about DNA. And while doing this, he dropped one of the girls and it caused a dent or a mark in the bathtub. That's how hard they fell.
Oh.
Ian, of course, said that this was caused by his dog. Hmm. We're not sure what happened because he's a dirty, rotten liar. After the girls were washed, he cleaned his house, just trying to get rid of any evidence he could think of. And after 8 p.m. that night, they claim that Ian wrapped the girls in a blanket and put them in the trunk of his car. He then drove 30 minutes to the Air Force Base, the one that he would go to watch the planes. And then the guy, I'm telling you, worried about DNA,
mm-hmm.
he placed trash bags over his feet so he would avoid any type of shoe prints.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he's pretty smart in that way, but dumb in others.
Oh, yeah. He didn't think of it all. He took the girls out of the car one by one, placed them in the stagnant water on their back. Then cut the clothes off their bodies and left them there. Once back in Soham, he took the clothes, put them in the barrel found by the shed on the school grounds, and poured gasoline over them. And they think once he saw the smoke from the, once it started fire, there was black smoke,
mm-hmm.
and he put it out quickly,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Because he panicked, yeah.
So after cleaning up, goes back home, he takes a shower, doesn't want to look like he's been in some 6-foot water stenchy ditch. He took a can of gasoline back to the Air Force Base where he left the girls, and he poured the entire contents out on top of them and he set them on fire. Then he walked away and he left and went to visit his grandma's house. His grandma lived nearby.
To say hi? Hey, Graham.
Yeah, just for a little visit.
I wonder if that was to set sort of an alibi. Like, why would he do that?
He then would, like, go back and help with the search. Like, he was always constantly involved in the search. He would always be asking questions. He's just like they usually do, right? They always want to get involved in the whole thing.
Ugh.
When Maxine was called to the stand, she cried, and she started telling the jury about how her now ex-boyfriend, Ian Huntley, had made her lie. Quote, "I'm not going to be blamed for what that thing in the box," meaning Ian, "has done to me and those kids." She claimed that Ian was very controlling and that she had been scared of him. She also admitted to lying and giving Ian an alibi. She claimed that Ian had pressured her into telling the lie to the police.
That's not true. She did that on her own.
And she really believed Ian when he told her that the girls left after talking with him.
No.
Quote, she said, "I thought they were alive when they left my house because that man said so." The jury deliberated for 17 hours and 32 minutes. They didn't believe that the girls died by accident. Ian received 2 life terms with a recommendation that he serve at least 40 years. The judge told him, quote, "You showed no mercy and you showed no regret. You are the only person who knows how you murdered them." So, and just have you say, Ian's not doing so well in prison. He's been attacked many times. Seems like he's unpopular.
Because he's a baby killer. He's a kid killer.
Well, and he's as popular in prison as he was in school. They all hate him.
I'm not laughing. Yeah, I am. I'm laughing at him. Mm-hmm. So there you go. You know, we all know baby killers do not fare well.
Oh, not at all.
Pedophiles.
Not at all. Especially on something this large. I mean, he's going to be famous before he even got to prison.
Yeah, I'm surprised they don't lock him in solitary confinement.
Solitary. They did for a while, but whatever.
Usually they beg to get out because it drives them crazy. You know, like you're alone all the time. That would be maddening, I would think.
I think one guy poured hot water all over him, scalded him.
Ooh.
He also was a friend of Ian Sutcliffe, the killer.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
I think that's him. I'm not for sure, but he did befriend some famous murderer in prison. Maxine Carr was sentenced to 3.5 years of imprisonment after being found guilty of conspiring with Ian. She was told by Mr. Justice Moses that she would serve half of her sentence in jail and the remainder on license, or basically parole. He addressed Maxine, quote, "You had plenty of opportunity to refuse to persist in a course of lying and deception. You chose not to. If you had the slightest true regard for those girls or families, you would have told the truth."
Exactly. That's what Maxine, I said earlier. Mm-hmm. Like, if somebody comes to you and asks you to do an alibi, why am I lying for you? Like, obviously something's not right.
Yeah. And anyway, Maxine was released in May of 2004. She'd only served 1 year and 9 months. Everybody, she had to change her name and go live elsewhere.
I was going to say, those families pissed or what?
I believe she went under police protection. That's how bad it was.
I would think
she
would have
to. I don't think she changed her name. I think the police did.
Yeah. So is she living in Utah or Idaho? That's the joke.
We have no idea. I don't think
she's. The joke in the U.S.
I think, and I'm not for sure, it was just a glance. Like, my head is so full of information on this. I think I glanced and it said something about now she has a child herself. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. But anyway, that's all I have on the case. But I do want to say one of the books that I got the information from was from Bernard O'Mahony. Remember, he's the one that the book Flowers in God's Garden, he wrote about little Rosie Palmer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He's the one that wrote The Killer and got him to trust him and all that kind of stuff. Remember that?
Uh-huh.
He posed as a female.
Yeah.
He also did this with Ian.
And Ian
didn't give him much, you know, and he turned over all the letters Ian ever wrote to him to the police so they could see what they could come up with. But one thing that he does say was very chilling that Ian did tell him. Bernard wrote Ian under the alias of Emma, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he said that, quote, "The letter I received from Huntley on the 22nd of January really shocked me. Huntley asked Emma if she would send him a photograph of her wearing a Manchester United shirt."
Shut. I just got chills.
I know.
Seriously?
Horrible.
Oh, my God.
Can you?
Yeah, you know what? He probably did so much more to those little girls.
And just couldn't.
We don't know.
I mean, why bathe? I don't know. I don't know. The other book I used is called Goodbye, Dearest Holly. 10 years on, written by Kevin Wells, that's Holly's father. It's really sad. It's really sad. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
He actually now is involved with a charity by the name of Grief Encounters, which I think deals with childhood grief and trauma.
Mm-hmm.
He also has done something with to try to get some kind of reform to have, I believe, background checks, to have stricter background checks, because the school should have checked harder for
Always.
Ian Huntley, you know?
Yeah.
He should have never been hired. And they all know that. They accept it.
Yeah.
They've changed policies.
Yeah.
The other book I used was called Beyond Evil, Inside the Twisted Mind of Ian Huntley by Nathan Yates. Nathan Yates was one of the main journalists that covered the case for the newspapers and so on. So he was on the scene and he was really good resource, along with Bernard and Kevin, mind you. But those were both great resources. And I suggest if you're interested in to get more in depth of the story, get these books and read them. They're available on Kindle. But and vast other BBC links and all other videos on YouTube. And I was so inundated with information, I had a really hard time writing this all down because things just kept flooding in my head.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to streamline it, you know?
It is, because
well,
there's so
it.
Much information you want to put down. I
three
mean,
people
I could go
wrote
into...
three books, and you're condensing it all down to an hour plus.
An hour or so?
Yeah.
Right.
It's crazy.
And with all the stuff on the computer, with all the YouTube stuff, and each video that is done, they have a certain angle that they want to do. This one wants to focus on Ian. This one wants to focus on the families. This one wants to focus on the search. So trying to compile them is difficult.
Yep.
And
get you.
The one thing that they all had in common was Ian Huntley is a piece of
shit. Was that it?
That's it. That's it. That was the main consensus of all the information I had.
Not a nice person.
Horrible human being.
And you know what?
It's horrible.
I mean, how many of these podcasts have we done where they all, there's always signs. I love saying that, but it's true. Mm-hmm. And then it's like a hill. They keep gathering stuff, and it always ends this way. It's so
And
awful.
One of them, one of the information said that he also did what? He hurt animals.
Yeah.
Like his friends commented how he would violently treat animals, and I won't go into what he did, they're horrible.
Don't want to know.
Just like him.
Yeah.
But
well, that was good,
Jen. And it goes into his parents didn't believe that he would ever be accused of something like this. And
well, you never think that. Nobody thinks that. Who does that? I mean, that is evil walking on this earth. That's insane.
I don't know.
Steal two baby girls? Are you kidding me?
Ugh. He lured all these kids into the house. And at one point, it said that once this all came out, there were tons of other women that would come forward saying, oh, yeah, he raped me, or... He, you know, I tried to go to the police, but nothing happened. Nothing ever came about. And horrible. He was a serial rapist.
Predator. He's a predator.
Pedophile.
Yeah,
predator.
He's terrible.
Going to say horrible human being. A horrible human being again, but how many times can I say it?
Sometimes if the name fits, you got to wear it. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
Well, good job, Jen. That was terrible.
Thanks.
Now I got to go Google it because, you know, that's what I do.
The girls are just precious, of course.
All
kids are precious.
Just a little matching. Like, oh, God, that's heartbreaking. Yeah, I can't even.
I watched a video, and it's of her friend and a friend of Holly's and the girls, but it was a video of her and Holly, and they're, like, dancing in the backyard.
They're 10. Like, you're doing... Yeah,
my youngest is 12, and it's... Yeah.
They're fixing each other's hair. They're, you know, talking about their friends in school and, you know,
it's just so wrong. Heartbreaking case. It really is.
Well, you did a good job. And I know there was a lot to it. So way to go. High five.
Yeah. But quickly, did you have a good Thanksgiving? Did everybody have a good Thanksgiving?
Yes.
What'd you do, Camille?
They all did. They just told me.
No, they didn't?
Nothing. Yeah. Laid low. I loved it. Laid low. Yeah. My mom came over and I had a little scare, thought I might have COVID, so I had to go get tested for that, and I did not, thank goodness. So I did not have a turkey ready to go, so I had to go get turkey, a little turkey tenderloin, which was fine. It was fine. It was good. So, yeah.
Well, it was my first time making a Thanksgiving dinner. I mean, I've made turkey before, and I made some of the other sides before, but I've never actually made the entire meal at once. My husband helped out by standing in the kitchen with me, telling me I was doing everything wrong. So that was always fun.
That's the role. That is the role.
But he was very helpful. He would clean the dishes as we went along. So that was very helpful.
Yeah, that helps.
But otherwise, the meal turned out fantastic. I was proud of myself.
I love Thanksgiving meal. It's one of my favorites ever.
It's yummy.
I'm a Missouri girl, so it's Thanksgiving and then barbecue. Those are my two favorite meals in the whole wide world.
Two things.
Yep. Love it. With all the sides. Like, it has to be a complete meal. So, you know, the barbecue has salad and pork and beans or baked beans, whatever you call them, barbecue beans, corn on the cob, you know, potato salad. That's my summer
meal. Now I'm hungry. I haven't had dinner yet. Have you had dinner?
Me neither. Nope. I got to go make food for the children's.
Well, I tell you what, this is going to air on Wednesday the 2nd?
Wednesday, yes.
Yep. That means that there is only one more week, one more Wednesday.
Regular episode
on the 9th,
and then bam, 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 all the way to 12.
After next Wednesday, we have 1, 2, 3 more sleeps before we start the Nightmare Before Christmas series.
Yeah, that is true.
And
it's going to be a good one, I think, this year.
I hope so. Anyway, if you don't know, the Nightmares Before Christmas, or the 12 Nightmares Before Christmas, we do one case a day. They're not as researched as what we normally do. They are usually shorter, or cases that we can't find a lot of information on. And we will let one out one a day. And we do the days according to body count.
Yep.
Does that make sense?
Yep. So you get 12, 12, 12 episodes in a row. One a day. That's pretty good.
One a day. Day one, you'd get one body, and then day 12, you'll have 12 bodies. I know it's morbid, but it's Christmas, and it's our gift to you.
It is our gift to you.
It's something you can do while
cooking, cleaning, shopping, wrapping.
Exactly.
Hanukkah.
Ignoring Hanukkah your family because they're driving
whatever.
You up the well.
Yeah.
Or driving you up the wall.
Well.
The well.
The
or
well.
The well. Whatever.
Whichever.
It's your choice. It's your family. I don't judge.
Oh, Jen. All right.
Promo this week is from our friends, the Dumb Found Dead podcast. I know one of the hosts, John. He's so funny. Definitely would check them out.
Definitely check them out.
Mm-hmm. John's funny. He makes me laugh.
Good to know. All right. So I'll be checking that out over Christmas break. Until then, Jen, remember, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya. Today's episode was researched and written by me, Jen. For more information about this episode, as well as all other sources, please check out our show notes or the podcast website at ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Our True Crime Podcast is developed and created by the hosts, Jen and Cam. Original music and audio mix of all Our True Crime Podcast episodes is courtesy of Nico Vertese from We Talk of Dreams. You can reach Nico at wetalkofdreams.com. Listener discretion is provided by Edward October from Octoberpod VHS. You can find all of his great works on YouTube. Please make sure to like and subscribe to Our True Crime Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. We can be reached on Instagram and Facebook at Our True Crime Podcast or on Twitter with the handle at Our True Crime Pod. You can also email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. We would also at this time like to thank our patrons. We would be so lost without you. Thank you so much. And if you would like to help support the show, you can check us out on patreon.com/ourtruecrimepodcast. You can also show your support by leaving a 5-star review on Apple or simply just tell your friends about us. It's that easy. Love ya. In with the bubble. In with the bumblebees.
I changed it.
Nope.
There's a
in with the butterflies, out with the bees. In with the butterflies, out with the
bees. In with the murder hornets, out with coronavirus.
Exactly. Yeah. Her contract wasn't. She didn't get recontracted. What's that called?
Renewed.
Renewed. Thank you.
It's okay.
Her contract didn't get renewed. I'm smart, man.
That's a marquee.
Searched their home. I put hame. Searched their hame.
Searched their hame.
I even used Grammarly. Come on, Grammarly. I guess it's grammar and not spellery, right? On
correct.
Saturday,
wordery. Wordery.
Yeah. Fix my mess ups, Lee. Right?
But yes.
You know what? I'll show them. I won't vacuum my house at all.
Hey, guess what? You don't now, so it's all good.
I know. I am going to make those police really work to find evidence.
Did she?
They're
going
to have to go through years, decades even, worth of grime to find evidence. I'm going to start that now.
I think you started it 5 years ago, Jen.
Maybe.
As did I. It's okay.
Yeah. All right. Anyway.
Do you enjoy dark comedy, puns, and laughter? If so, come join two good brothers, John and Patrick, as we discuss some of the craziest ways people die. That's so bizarre, strange, and borderline comical, that'll leave you dumbfounded. You can follow this podcast on all major platforms, such as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many more. And make sure to follow us on social media on Instagram at The Dumbfounded Pod and on Twitter at TDFD Pod. And remember, think ahead, don't be dumbfounded.